Good afternoon, folks. John McManus here. This afternoon's call-in conference call is on the top 10 estate planning issues for families that are separating or individuals that are entering into a new marriage after they have been divorced. Number one, addressing guardianship for minor children after death. So there are two issues. If you know someone who is getting separated or is getting divorced, we think that it's important that that they communicate with their divorce lawyers and set up in advance who the guardians should be. Why? Because even happily married couples often struggle with who they can agree to choose. We have a lot of well-built-out provisions which name advisory groups and guarantee family members visitation and so forth. But if your family members are of more modest means and they have not been able to have a law firm do this work for them, or our firm, for example, what you want to tell them is make sure that with your divorce lawyer and your, you know, soon-to-be ex-spouse's divorce lawyer, that you both agree to who the guardians should be. If your friends and family have already divorced, it's important that both divorcing spouses choose a guardian that they both can agree to on their documents. That doesn't always happen. And so clients say to us, my spouse who you've never met, John and Elizabeth, Ben and so forth, you've never met them, but you should know that they're not involved in my life. I don't want to choose them as the guardian. We think that there is a possibility in those sets of facts that the court would honor your wishes, but you need to know that primarily the biological parent will have the first say. As your children get older and are into their teen years, their decision as to who their guardian would be if you passed away would be much more heated and H-E-E-D-E-D and by a judge and valued. So you do have that issue. But it is key to understand that you not naming who your former spouse or you not naming who your spouse has agreed to doesn't guarantee that the children will go in that direction. It is better to have it in the settlement. And we think it's important to have that discussion with your former spouse at the time that you're doing your planning and to say, here is who I'm choosing. Will you agree to that as well? We may not get acquiescence there, but at least you're trying. Okay, second issue. For those of you who have family members, and this is a sad set of facts, but if they're divorcing and they have wills and they've left everything to their surviving spouse, under their will, but they're still in the middle of divorcing, you need to indicate to them that even if they're at the edge of signing a separation agreement, if they pass away at that time, their spouse will receive everything. And many times we've heard clients say that, you know, after the divorce is done, they want just to leave the money directly, whatever they have remaining, to their children. And so if you have family members and you know that they're in the middle of this divorce, they may say, listen, my spouse, former spouse is getting this portion, but I'm going to leave the remainder of it down to my children. Well, unless they revise their wills immediately, then if they pass away, their spouse will get it all. And that may be problematic because their spouse may be in a new relationship already and may be getting married. And it may mean that these children never see the assets. So, again, couple divorcing, spouse would get half. If the divorcing couples die, that spouse gets it all, and that will go to that spouse and their new relationship and may never go down to the children. Clients have to have the wills modified immediately. Sometimes we hear through third parties that, and this is part two to paragraph two, the elective share. So spouse says that, you know, we're getting divorced, and so I only want to leave to my spouse, the most modest amount, because if we're getting divorced? Well, the answer here is if a client is revising their will and saying, I want to leave it all to the children and not to the spouse, social policy and the laws in the tri-state area, and nearly every state in the nation is this way, says that you cannot disinherit your spouse. So spouses are entitled to a minimum amount of, typically, of one-third of the estate. A very, very, very important concept here. By that, we mean that husband and wife are separating. If you have friends that the husband and wife are separating and the spouse says, you know I've got to give half to my spouse in divorce, but right now we're just separating. If I die, I want it all to go to the children. Well, the answer is the spouse will always get one-third as long as they're married. After the divorce, then that spouse is no longer part of the family and would not get the third. They got their half in the divorce, but they would get no more. Clients have also said, well, can I leave the piece that I'm leaving to my spouse in trust, and then at least if they remarry, I know that it'll go back to, on their death, it'll go back to my children and not to my spouse's new spouse. The answer is, it all depends. In classic legalese, it depends on the state. In the New York metropolitan area, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, state to state, there are issues as to whether or not you can leave the piece you want to leave to your estranged or separated spouse. You can in trust. If you leave it in trust, some instances you have to leave more than the third, the elective share. But it's an important discussion to have in advance of the of doing the wills. Okay, number three, incapacity planning during separation. So, if your friends and family, you know, have put together documents where they've named their spouse as their agent to make all of their health care decisions, and, you know, clients classically use that thing, you know, like pulling the plug. Well, for our clients, it's not really pulling the plug. We have a much more comprehensive, well-thought-out series of steps that happen before anybody would remove life support, and it's really the directive is built into the document. It's not that a estranged spouse could, quote, pull a plug. But an estranged spouse could be making decisions, and we would never expect them to be acting maliciously, but they may not be acting with the vigor and the enthusiasm that you would want them to if you were estranged from them. So we recommend to our clients when they're speaking with family members and friends to say, when you have decided that you're going to separate, one of the worst things in the world that we hear, you know, and no different from death in some instances, you need to understand that at that time you should have somebody doing separately being your power of attorney. Someone separately being your health care agent, because if you become incapacitated, the people that you've named are your estranged spouse who you are commencing a divorce with or even in a heated divorce. So it's critical that those pieces are addressed at the time of the estrangement. It is also important to know when we've had situations where people have become incapacitated during that, and then the rest of the family is fighting to make the decisions for that spouse, that is not what you want to be involved. Okay, number four is life insurance and divorce settlements. It is an important piece to know that for your, you know, if you know someone who is receiving life insurance from their divorced spouse as part of, as a insurance policy, so to speak, to protect against support. So husband and wife separate, husband has continued obligations to wife under my fact pattern for this instance, whatever it is, $5,000-$10,000 a month. But if the husband dies, how does the former wife and children continue to be assured of that stream of child support and alimony? Well, that's normally covered with a life insurance policy that the divorce lawyers put together. In that instance, though, the divorce lawyers are focusing on divorce, not on doing estate planning. So in this instance, if the former husband passes away and the insurance policy is to go to his former wife, that's fine. That policy will pass, and because it's a contract, not a gift. It's a debt that is the husband owed to the former wife. There's no tax there. But now the surviving former spouse has those assets in her estate, and now they will be included for tax purposes when she passes away down to her children. So it is our recommendation that if we hear through friends and family that people are getting divorced and there is insurance, meaningful insurance involved here, that the spouse, that the two parties request that it be held in a life insurance trust. Surviving spouse can be the trustee, can be the beneficiary. Surviving spouse can continue to use it. On surviving spouse's death, it goes down to the children free of tax. The other important value here is that if the surviving spouse remarries, those assets are now included in her estate for her new spouse to attack with the right of election when she dies. But if they're in this life insurance trust, they will go down to the children from the first marriage and be protected. Very, very, very important consideration. So the tax planning, and also to ensure that the money stays in the original family and down to the children of that first marriage. Number five is asset titling. Very important piece here. We're involved, and typically we're involved in a couple of cases where these things come up, where we weren't representing the families necessarily, but husband and wife were married and then they divorced, and the wife gets her piece, husband gets his piece, but one of them fails to change the beneficiary designation. So in this set of facts, husband gives the wife real estate, retirement, homes, and keeps retirement for himself, but then he passes, or he becomes incapacitated, or he passes away, and he never changed the beneficiary designation on his accounts. Now, by law, the argument would be under the divorce that that spouse should not be entitled to that piece. But suppose it was several years later, and still he never followed up with that. There can be inferences made, and we have seen it happen when we've had clients come in who've been divorced saying, I still care about my former wife, I want to leave a portion of my estate to her or him. And so in this instance, if there was an IRA that had $1 million and it named the named the former spouse, a court could say that was the intention of the deceased husband. So when you're speaking with friends and family, if they're suffering here in the divorce, make sure that after the divorce, even during the divorce, to consider changing all the beneficiary designations and naming the people they really want, maybe the children and so forth. Okay. Next is prenuptial agreement. So this is for those of you on the phone who have children that are entering into marriages, or for those of you who have friends that are entering into second marriages. This is a typical strategy to enter into a prenuptial agreement. Fortunately for us and for many of you on the phone, this is not a worry that you have, because the assets that you are leaving to your children will be in trust, and that they will be protected in the event that your children, perish the thought, would get divorced. For those of you who have friends who, you know, we're not talking about inheriting, they've just received the money they've had under their first marriage and divorce, those assets are assets that when they marry may not be the object of divorce, because if they keep them on their side of the balance sheet in the second marriage and they get divorced, they would argue to the divorce court that, listen, these are the assets I brought to the marriage and I've kept them on my side of the balance sheet, they're not part of it, and are likely to prevail. There's some complexities that go beyond the scope of this call that they may not fully get that. But the issue goes back to this point, and it's one of the most important pieces on this call, is this right of election. So now spouse enters into the second marriage, does not do a prenuptial agreement, but then passes away. And that spouse believed that all those assets were going to go down to their children from the first marriage. But the new husband now is entitled to maybe one-third of those assets under the right of election. And so how do you protect against that? Well, we actually have a client that just recently, and it's not the first time we've heard that, to say, you know, I am a romantic, I am a widow, or, you know, my first marriage was one thing, but my second one now, I'm sure it's going to be right. I feel that it is inelegant to sign a prenuptial agreement, and because I think that it shows that we're starting off on the wrong foot. We support families as well. We could see how that could be the case. We also think that some clients will not sign a prenuptial because they don't want to disclose to their new spouse they're about to get married to what assets they have. Part of any prenuptial agreement has to be a full and adequate disclosure so that both parties know what they're coming into. Essential to this piece, then, is one, we encourage prenuptials because we think it's important not for divorce, but that that any of your friends or your children should know that if they die, their spouse, their second spouse or their new spouse is entitled to a portion of those assets unless they waive the right, and a prenuptial agreement, you can waive the right of election, of the spouse. So husband and wife sign a prenuptial, wife dies, husband cannot exercise his right to take a portion of the estate. We haven't seen it challenged. It is something that we're not completely convinced is the most effective way. We don't know whether the new spouse, the surviving second spouse, says, you know, it wasn't fully disclosed, I wasn't represented by counsel, I was forced. We don't know. I mean, that is not our business, divorce law. But what we do know is that it is worthy of consideration of prenuptial in a second marriage or for children who are going to inherit money, even though our clients and all of you are leaving your money to your children in trust. And typically for their lifetime, those assets would be protected. A strategy around that, however, and that's going to Article 7, is the following. So we have had several clients say, both before they've entered into a second marriage and after they've entered into a second marriage, when they found out about this right of election, have said, well, my goodness, you know, I didn't sign a prenuptial, or I found a prenuptial inelegant, what can I do? And the answer is, you know, I've always been thinking that my husband comes to the marriage with his own assets, I love him dearly, but what if I die and he becomes incapacitated and his children, on his behalf, exercise the right of election against my estate, so I have $8 million and I die, and I'm anticipating leaving that between my five children, and now my new husband, who survived me, his children say, guess what? You know, we didn't get any money, and my dad was married to your mom for 15 years, and he should be entitled to a portion, and we're going to exercise his right of election. Well, in that set of facts, $8 million, 33% of it, one third of it, you know, do the math, it's over $2.5 million. So, how do you protect against that? Well, there is no foolproof way to do that. One thing that we have had clients consider is making significant gifts in trust to their children while they're alive, or even making a significant gift to their second spouse and then on the second spouse's death, down to the children in trust. It's a special time, as you know, right now, where you can give up to $5 million away. And so if we had a client that said, sweetheart, I'm going to leave you a $5 million worth of assets in trust right now. I'm going to name my oldest child from my first marriage to serve as a co-trustee. If I die, you will, you'll continue to live on these assets, but on your death, those assets will go back to my children from the first marriage, and my oldest child will assist you in managing it. We know that by doing that, the $5 million would not be able to be the right of election be exercised by when that If that husband's children from his own marriage came in and said we want a third of it, those would be protected. So we strongly recommend that, or just creating a trust and leaving a significant amount beyond what you need today directly down to your children today. We have had some clients consider leaving, if they had $5 million, taking $2 million today and putting it in a trust that's offshore, meaning outside of the tri-state area, and places like Delaware, Alaska, South Dakota. And in those states, our clients can still be a beneficiary of the trust. So they name the children. The children would only be discretionary beneficiaries. Spouse says, look, I have another 30 years on this planet. This money, I know if I die, will not be subject to the right of election from my new husband. I also know that since it's in Delaware, I can be a discretionary beneficiary, and the trustee can give me money if I need some of this $2 million. Our clients or friends of yours can still always borrow from that trust. We build a trust to be what we call defective or a grantor trust, where they can always borrow from that, even though they've given the $2 million to their kids in trust. Just keep that in mind as a strategy. Okay. Number eight on our list here is incorporating a new spouse into incapacity planning. So once you remarry, if you have family members that are remarrying and so forth, or for our single clients who are remarrying, remember that it's an important time then to consider naming your new spouse on your documents, which may still linger from years ago from a first spouse, or you may have redone the work and your children are named on there. But now you've remarried, and now you have a potential conflict here, and a sad one, because, you know, the second marriage may be the perfect marriage, the one you've wished for all along, and then you become incapacitated, and your children never got along very well with your second spouse. Well, you need to sit and have a conversation. Who do you want to be making medical decisions and business decisions for you? A very, very, very important piece to think through. So upon remarriage or developing a significant other into your life, you need to contemplate who you want to make the decisions for you. And that can evolve as well as the relationship enriches. One of the risks, though, that you have is that when you remarry, and you name your new spouse as having the power of appointment, the power of attorney under your documents, we have a difficult struggle here. And you'll say, why? Well, so imagine that you've been very clear with your spouse and you've said, look, I've left money, we've signed a prenuptial agreement, you're not going to have any of my assets in my estate, you have your own. I'm leaving you some money, but the balance I'm leaving to the kids. And the surviving spouse, the healthy spouse, your second spouse's children get into the middle of it, and they say, you know, you've been caring for this second woman, spouse of yours for the past 20 years. You're only getting pennies. Is that a fair deal? And so if that second spouse has the power of attorney, that second spouse could then be in a set of facts where they start moving assets into their name. So we often recommend that with respect to powers of attorney, and that's business matters, not the medical matters, if it's a second spouse, often consider having a child on there so that you have your spouse's best interest at heart, your second spouse, and your children's by having them act jointly. A very important concept, again, when you're in a situation where there is a remarriage. Okay, I'm on to nine. Life insurance preservation and wealth transfer via gifts prior to and after marriage. While you're in a significant set of facts where you have life insurance for your new spouse, we would strongly urge you not to just, when you have family members that are buying insurance again and they're remarrying, have that insurance in trust, okay? For us, our clients are often putting their insurance in trust because of the profoundly powerful estate tax reasons. But the additional piece when it's a second marriage is saying, look, I want to provide some liquidity for my new spouse because I'm leaving the majority of my assets to my children from the first marriage. We get that, and that's a wonderfully romantic and important duty that you're taking care of. And that spouse should receive it. But if it's not put to that spouse in trust, one, you have an estate tax when that spouse passes away. But number two is that spouse who's received it on his or her death, that money should cycle back to your side of the family. So very, very, very important concept here that we want to emphasize, that take care of your second spouse, but be mindful that that money, particularly life insurance, all your other assets as well, should cycle back to the family. I'm going to digress, but one very important concept that we think is critical here, and this is essential to be mindful of that, and that is for your children who are marrying and they're in their 20s or early 30s, and we see many of these come in, they say, listen, we have no children, but I've inherited money from my parents, or I've been formally married and I have assets now, or my parents are passing assets to us, I'm a business owner and so forth, so it's not coming to me in trust. The problem is when children marry young, is you want them to be responsible and take care of their surviving spouse. That's the highest priority. But part two here is that if the surviving spouse inherits those assets, they may be alive for another 40 or 50 years, and they may never be plugged back into the rest of the family. And so that's okay, because that was the lottery of life, and sad, but that's the lottery of life. But we want to know that if our client's child marries young and then dies, that spouse should receive those assets, but they should go in trust for that spouse. And that even if they had no children, and that spouse gets to use that money during his or her lifetime, but on that spouse's death, the money then cycles back to your original family, whether it's your deceased child's siblings or back to you, but that money should, or charities, whatever, that's why we always have trust for even our clients who are getting married in their 20s and don't have any children. Okay? All right, the last piece is the self-settled trust. And this is the piece I spoke about to you before. I was talking about it in paragraph 7. The idea here is if you have clients, friends, and or children who have significant assets, they have to know that we're not assured that a prenuptial agreement is going to work in death as effectively as it would a divorce. In divorce, couples get together, they sign a prenuptial, then they divorce, everybody is presented there, everybody was represented by counsel, everybody knows what the intentions of the parties were, and it's often very little fighting, except in the Trump divorces with prenuptial. But what happens is with the prenuptial is death, and now your child or your friend's spouse, your friend's pass away, and their spouse says, that prenuptial I signed, you know, I was tricked into it or whatever, I never knew what the details were, my counsel was, you know, appointed by my wife's counsel and really wasn't acting vigorously on my part, and they go in and they challenge the estate to take a portion of it. So we believe that to avoid some of those risks, it is important to consider making gifts either before entering the marriage, and we just did one, but we're always doing them in advance of marriage, or afterwards to make those gifts for children and loved ones that would be separate from what the spouse would be entitled to receive. And if they want to maintain access into those gifts, if they've given it, so they say, listen, I have 5 or I have 50. You know, if I have 50, I'm fine with giving 5 or 10 into trust for my children today. Even if they don't have access, I at least know that would not be part of what my second spouse could have. They also, but if they have $5 million, they say, listen, I'm only willing to give $2 million away today to know that that's protected, but I want to have access to it. And so as you can see in our checklist on number 10, we talk about doing these self-settled trusts in the Delaware, Alaskas. We have Nevada here. South Dakota is another one that we use. And in this instance, there is a great level of protection, and that would be insulated from attack in the right of election.
Aye.